Today is Wednesday, June 10th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, George Floyd, the black man whose killing by a white police officer sparked outrage around the world, was laid to rest Tuesday following an impassioned funeral.
Breath is sanctified. Breath is sacred. You don't have the right to take God's breath out of anybody. You can't put breath in their body.
Burundi's president has died of a heart attack.
I think what he represented during his reign was really the Bush generation that fought during the Burundian Civil War.
Also ahead, the latest on the coronavirus pandemic still gripping parts of the world. It's all on today's International Edition. Hundreds of mourners wearing masks packed a Houston, Texas church Tuesday for the funeral of George Floyd, the black man whose death has inspired a worldwide reckoning over racial injustice. During the service, Floyd's niece, Brooke Williams, emotionally questioned why it had to happen.
Their officer showed no remorse while watching my uncle's soul leave his body. He begged and pleaded many times just for you to get up, but you just pushed harder. Why must this system be corrupt and broken?
Floyd's body was carried in a horse-drawn carriage to his final resting place next to his mother, whom he cried out for in his last breaths. AP correspondent Jennifer King has more on the moving funeral on Tuesday.
George Floyd died on May 25th after being pinned to the pavement by a white Minneapolis police officer. His death ignited protests against racism and police brutality around the world. Dozens of Floyd's family members, dressed in white, were led into the sanctuary by the Reverend Al Sharpton.
We are fighting wickedness in high places.
Funeral speakers included Joe Biden, who delivered videotaped remarks, and Texas Representative Sheila Jackson Lee.
There will be no more 8 minutes and 46 seconds that you will be in pain without getting justice.
Floyd's niece, Brooke Williams, moved the crowd.
America, it is time for a change.
Floyd's body was taken by horse-drawn carriage to a cemetery in Pearland, where he was to be laid to rest next to his mother. I'm Jennifer King.
George Floyd's death has triggered a groundswell of outrage and activism and calls for racial justice and rethinking the concept of public safety through police in the United States. Many are calling for defunding the police. It's a concept that has been interpreted as eliminating the police, but some activists say it's really a call for restructuring, diverting funds to other services police are not trained to deal with, such as domestic violence, addiction, and mental health services. Joining us to discuss all of this, as well as how recent events have impacted police themselves, who are simply trying to protect communities. Jason Johnson is president of the Law Enforcement Legal Defense Fund. Thank you for being with us. First, how is the law enforcement community coping with what's happening?
As you might imagine, it's extremely difficult. I just reflect on my personal experience, on my own knowledge of police officers, that people become police officers because they want to serve their communities. They want to help people, but they also want to be considered one of the good guys or one of the good gals. They don't want to be lumped in with negativity or people who are bad. So it's very disorienting, I think, for a lot of cops when they join, you know, this career that they felt they were doing the right thing or that they were joining the good guys. And now all of a sudden everything is turned around and they're feeling like they're lumped in with wrongdoers or criminals. You know, it's disenchanting. The long-term effects could be very, very bad for people choosing law enforcement as a career, which, of course, the most concerning part about that is that you actually wind up with the instead of improving policing, which is what everyone wants. I mean, all of these conversations about even the defunding conversation, which I don't know that there's a monolith of what defunding means. I think different people mean different things about it. But I think pretty much everybody agrees they want policing to improve. Making the career or the profession of policing into the bad guys, it's going to be sort of self-perpetuating. Because people who are the good guys and gals are going to be less inclined to engage in a career that has where there's such negative connotation.
Are there some in the police community that are angry at seeing things like what happened with George Floyd, angry in general that there are officers doing these things?
Yeah, I have, as you might imagine, after a career in local policing in two different agencies, all different levels of the organization, that I more or less surround myself socially and professionally with people who are cops or were cops. And I would say that there is universal outrage at the treatment that George Floyd received. I've never really seen before. I think that these high-profile cases always result in conversations in police circles about, was it right, was it wrong, is the public understanding of this case accurate? I haven't talked to or heard or viewed a social media post or anything else coming from a law enforcement officer or even former law enforcement officer that was supportive in any way, and most people in law enforcement have condemned it. With any other person charged with a crime, obviously these officers are entitled to due process under the law. They're entitled to a presumption of innocence. But what we see there on tape is not acceptable. And in my view, it was a crime. So it hurts police officers to see that because they know they're going to get lumped in with that, and they don't feel that represents them.
As far as the rethinking of policing or defunding of police, a lot of people, I think, may be misinterpreting that it's to get rid of police rather than rethinking the concept of public safety and maybe diverting some of those funds to other things that police officers are not trained to do, like dealing with addiction, overdose, mental health services, and maybe diverting those funds to not having police have to be called to those sorts of situations. Do you think that there is at least room for that conversation?
Yes, absolutely, without question. I actually think it's probably an overdue conversation. I think most in law enforcement would agree. I think police and law enforcement in general are the government service of last resort and have in some cases been saddled with providing services in areas that are outside of the expertise of law enforcement. Sometimes can inflame situations. Just the mere presence of a law enforcement officer can sometimes escalate a mental health crisis, for example. So law enforcement officers were probably not a good choice for a response model. And so I agree personally, our organization agrees, and I think generally law enforcement agrees that revisiting or rethinking or re-engineering that is a good idea. Defunding is an unfortunate name. It implies something that I think maybe is not accurate for most advocates of defunding. They don't really mean defund. You know, if you no longer need to hire as many officers, your budget goes down because it's going to be rerouted to social service providers. So indirectly, but I think it has such a negative, it makes people feel like that means we're not going to have police anymore. It just kind of undermines the argument. That I think is when it's presented the way you just presented it and the way I've heard it, proponents of it present it, it is a conversation that should be had. Devil is in the details, of course, but I definitely think it's a conversation worth having. I also think there should be a new push, for national standards of policing, national professional standards for training, for internal accountability, for data collection, and all these sorts of things I think are all great ideas. Federal police reform legislation that really impacts the need for there to be national standardization and national professionalization of police in a way that would actually enhance the professional standing and assist with recruiting and everything else.
Right, because some cities then won't be able to make rules that are okay to, for example, put a knee on a neck like we just witnessed. There would be sort of across the board rules.
Yeah, there's 18,000 police agencies in the country, and they're not all sophisticated. So many of them have outmoded, outdated policies, insufficient technology, equipment to be remedied. I think we're at a place now where there is enough political will to do it, and I think now is probably the time. But to enact legislation that further undermines police and makes it even a less attractive profession, it's just not the direction that we need to go. I do agree with, although I can't say out loud that I agree with defunding the police, I agree with some of those concepts. I think they should be explored, and I certainly agree with enhancing professionalization. I think those are two areas where there could be bipartisan support, and I think there can be support in law enforcement and in cross-section of the community.
Jason Johnson, president of the Law Enforcement Legal Defense Fund, thank you for being with us. President Donald Trump sparked fresh controversy Tuesday over his hardline law and order push by peddling another unfounded conspiracy theory, this time about a protester shoved by police in Buffalo, New York. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
75-year-old Martin Gugino still in the hospital after hitting his head on the sidewalk. The president tweets the confrontation may have been a setup, that Gugino might be part of Antifa and appeared to be scanning police communications to black out officers' equipment. There's no evidence anything like that happened. The president's being criticized by Republicans like Senator Lisa Murkowski, who said, "Oh, Lord, ugh." and Democrats like New York Governor Andrew Cuomo.
How reckless, how irresponsible, how mean, how crude.
Saying the president should show some decency and apologize. Aides have been urging the president to take a more unifying tone toward the protests, worrying his words are boosting Democrats. Sagar Magani, Washington.
The wave of anti-racist protests in the United States, triggered by the death of George Floyd, have also continued in Europe. The toppling of a monument of a slave trader in the English city of Bristol inspired demands for similar symbols of a brutal imperial past to be removed. Tuesday in Belgium, the statue of King Leopold II was damaged and ultimately removed. Joining us to talk about how this conversation is spreading across the continent is Paris-based journalist Catherine Field. Catherine, clearly this issue is resonating.
It is very much the same feeling that there is a new generation that has come along and is seizing this moment to say there is a lot that should have been done before now, and we're going to make sure that it happens. And when you look at what's happening in Belgium, we've had a statue in Antwerp to King Leopold II to be pulled down. Of course, Leopold II, he reigned 1865 to 1909. He's accused of exploiting what is today the Democratic Republic of Congo. And the history of this man has never really been taught in Belgium. And so younger people are coming along and saying, look, you know, this was not a good leader. We do have to look at what he did to the society, how he ruled Congo, how exploitative was his regime, how many millions of people died in that African nation. And are these historic issues that just haven't been dealt with. And it's been coming along. You know, the Belgium has been needing to think about its colonial history, needing to come to a reckoning with it. And this coming at the same time as the Black Lives Matters movement has really given it impetus. And it's not just been that statue in Antwerp. There's also in Genf, there was a bust of King Leopold II in the center of town that was defaced, it had red paint put on it, and it's now there, and it's standing there with a placard around its neck saying, I can't breathe.
And it's happening elsewhere in Paris, too, where you are.
Indeed, here in Paris during rush hour on Tuesday evening, thousands and thousands of people gathered into Republic Square, Place de la République, in the center of Paris. 8 minutes, 49 seconds. They were just kneeling. They were quiet. Again, it was the same placards that we've seen being held up around Europe. I can't breathe, and Black Lives Matter. Now, of course, there is a similar case going on here in France to Floyd. There's a case of police brutality, alleged police brutality. They haven't had their day in court for the man who died in police custody. But again, it's a whole new generation that you are seeing out on the streets who are saying something has to change now. And they're clearly, even though a week has gone by, they are not letting it rest. They're coming back out on the streets.
Feels like change in the air all over, potentially triggered by the death of George Floyd.
Indeed it is. And even in England, you've seen old grievances, again, statues of slave traders not just being pulled down in cities like Bristol, but also in London. The mayor is starting to talk about taking down some of the statues in London that are also to slave traders. And it's not only just taking down the statues. I'm noticing more on the media, more on your mainstream media, radio and television, more reports now about what these countries' so-called businessmen, traders did when they left England, when they left Belgium, and when they went to areas in Africa. You're seeing much more of that, and you're seeing many more questions about what are the root causes of present-day human rights violations, and that this whole scope of not just the violence that was inflicted during the colonization period, but also the injustices there. And there is a feeling, particularly when you look at some of the recommendations, that there just hasn't been enough taught in schools, and there hasn't been enough of the public distancing of these people who carried out these injustices. And by that, I mean the statues, the place names, particularly squares, particularly street names, not just here in mainland Europe, but also in England.
Paris-based journalist Catherine Field. The government of Burundi says President Pierre Nkurunziza died Tuesday at the age of 56. He joined politics during Burundi's bloody civil war in the 1990s and served three terms as Burundi's president beginning in 2005. His decision to run for a controversial third term in 2015 set off protests and violence that left hundreds dead and prompted hundreds of thousands of Burundians to flee the country. Nkurunziza was due to step down in August after his chosen successor won a 2020 presidential election that opposition candidates said was unfair. VOA's Jason Patinkin spoke to international crisis group's Nicolae Vandevolle, who begins by assessing the legacy that Nkurunziza leaves behind.
It's a bit mixed, to be honest. When you look at Pierre Nkurunziza, I think what he represented during his reign was really the Bush generation that fought during the Burundian Civil War. That was a scar generation that came into power after Burundi's troubled post-colonial era. So that's a bit mixed. But then what we also see is that Nkurunziza was not able to unite, to keep the party united during the 2015 political crisis. So there was an attempted coup d'etat in 2015. Nkurunziza decided to try for a contested third term, which he won. Then the rest of his reign was characterized by human rights violations. So a lot of people had to flee the country. Civil society actors were unable to act. International media and national media found it very difficult to operate. So that really divided and scarred the country. But then on the other hand, you can also see that at the end of his term, he was willing to step down. So in January, his party, the CNDD-FDD, elected a new candidate for the presidential elections, Evariste, who was indeed elected 2 weeks ago in the elections. And that showed that Nkurunziza, and that's why we can say it's a bit of a mixed legacy, because despite what happened before, he seemed willing to step down in the end.
And now looking forward, he was already going to be leaving power, but he wasn't going to be leaving entirely. Now that he has passed away, what impact might that have on the political situation in Burundi?
Yeah, I think that's a bit too soon to tell. He was indeed supposed to leave office on the 21st of August. Now what we see is that there will be the president of the National Assembly will be president at interim. So in this period between the elections and the new president Evariste assuming office, it is interesting to see how things will develop over the past few months, over the coming few months, yes. But Nkurunziza, indeed, he was supposed to become the supreme guide of patriotism, meaning that most people expected him to remain influential despite a new president assuming office. It remains to be seen what happens next.
Nekele Vandevolle with the International Crisis Group, speaking to VOA's Jason Patinkin. Turning now to the global coronavirus pandemic, the World Food Program is warning that the COVID-19 pandemic threatens food security in Nigeria's large urban areas, as well as conflicted affected communities in the unstable northeast. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Nigeria, Africa's biggest economy and most populous country, is reeling from the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic. A steep drop in international oil prices, Nigeria's major export since the outbreak of the coronavirus, has sparked fears of a recession. Nearly 12,500 cases of coronavirus, including 354 deaths, are confirmed in Nigeria. The United Nations reports lockdown measures aimed at containing spread of the deadly disease could result in as many as 13 million job losses if the restrictions go on for very much longer. The World Food Program warns this would unleash a situation of widespread hunger in a country where some 90 million people live on less than $2 a day. In response, the agency says it plans to scale up its operations to feed 3 million of the neediest people. WFP spokeswoman Elizabeth Beer says among those who will benefit from the program are city dwellers in Kano, Abuja, and Lagos, who are particularly hard hit by the socioeconomic knock-on effects from COVID-19. Others who will receive increased food and nutrition support, she says, are women, men, and children affected by a decade-long insurgency in the northeastern states of Borno, Adamawa, and Yobe.
We are concerned about conflict-affected communities in the northeast Nigeria who already face extreme hunger and who are especially vulnerable. They are on life support and need assistance to survive.
Beer says WFP is distributing a two-month supply of food and nutrition assistance in camps for displaced people to make sure they have enough to eat during the COVID lockdown period. She says WFP is providing technical support to strengthen government-run social protection programs. These include feeding programs for some 9 million children who are missing out on meals because of COVID-19 school closures. The agency is urgently appealing for $182 million to provide crucial assistance over the next 6 months in Nigeria. Much of the aid, it notes, will help people whose livelihoods and incomes have taken a big hit by COVID-19. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Disorganized responses to the coronavirus pandemic in Europe have led to concerns about how countries there will deal with a potential second wave. Joining us now is Paris-based reporter Nicolas Pinault. Nicolas, German Chancellor Angela Merkel and French President Emmanuel Macron on Tuesday urging the European Union to take action.
Yes, and they asking basically for Brussels and the European Commission's to be better prepared for the next pandemic. They wrote this letter to the European Commission chief, Ursula von der Leyen, and basically they say, we hope, and I quote, that this letter can serve as an inspiration for fruitful further discussions at European level on how to ensure the EU's preparedness for future pandemics. Basically, the French President Emmanuel Macron, Angela Merkel from Germany, and also the leaders from Poland, Spain, Belgium, and Denmark ask for better cooperation. Remember that during the pandemic, each state from the European Union, they deal themselves with the crisis, and basically they showed no solidarity between themselves. We saw some of them stealing some protective equipment from another, and there was really no coordination. And some countries, such as Spain or Italy, who suffered a great loss during the pandemic, they really condemned the behavior of other states during the pandemic. So these six leaders, they're really calling for a better preparation and especially better cooperation among the EU states.
And is there an example of some of the things they feel would really be helpful to do to have cooperation and to work together and prepare?
Yes, basically for them, it's such a shame that the European Union showed such a lack of medical supply, such personal protective equipment, ventilators, medical devices, or also vaccines. So some countries such as Spain and Italy, they have to rely on the United States a little bit and on China to receive those kind of equipments. And sometimes what happened, for example, in Germany or France, they simply ban the export of such medical equipments, which basically could have helped in their neighboring countries. So they want to make sure that the European Union is having those, of course, medical equipment. That's something they really, really stress about, the need of having those critical supplies.
Paris-based reporter Nicolas Pinault. Despite ongoing protests, 21 states in the U.S. have reported weekly increases in new COVID-19 cases. Arizona, Utah, and New Mexico in particular posted rises of 40% or higher. Here are some of the other stories we are following at VOA. The coronavirus might have been spreading in China as early as August of last year, according to Harvard Medical School research that's based on satellite images of hospital travel patterns and search engine data. China dismissed the report as ridiculous. The research used was from satellite imagery of hospital parking lots in Wuhan, China, where the disease was first identified in late 2019, and data for symptom-related queries on search engines. A United Nations human rights expert is voicing alarm at widespread food shortages and malnutrition in North Korea, made worse by a nearly five-month border closure with China and strict quarantine measures against COVID-19. The expert urged the UN Security Council to reconsider sanctions imposed on the isolated country over its nuclear and missile programs. And the U.S. Senate has confirmed General Charles Brown Jr. as chief of the U.S. Air Force. He is the first Black officer to lead one of the nation's military services. Vice President Mike Pence took the rare step of presiding over Tuesday's vote. It came as the Trump administration and the mostly white Senate Republican conference continue to grapple with the aftermath of the killing of George Floyd. Australia's spy chief is warning of a surge in espionage, extremist propaganda, and cybercrime during the COVID-19 crisis. Australian security intelligence organization boss Mike Burgess says, with more Australians at home and online during lockdowns, spies, criminals, and terrorists have been increasingly active. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
COVID-19 has given hackers, criminals and terrorists a world of opportunity to exploit Australians online during lockdowns. That's the view of ASIO, the Australian Security Intelligence Organisation. Its job is to prevent espionage, sabotage, acts of foreign interference and politically motivated violence in Australia. It believes that extremist groups have spread their ideology and tried to radicalise Australians. Other common scams include phishing for personal information, online shopping fraud, and the theft of pension funds, as well as fake cryptocurrency and celebrity endorsements. There are also allegations that foreign governments have used the pandemic to covertly gather sensitive information online. In a podcast with the Institute of Public Administration Australia, a non-partisan research body, ASIO Chief Mike Burgess said the coronavirus pandemic has provided opportunities for criminals and extremists.
We've seen more people at home, and as they're at home, they're online, and we've seen increased chatter in the online world when it comes to the spread of extremist ideology, attempting to radicalise people. So we've seen more of that, just as we've seen more criminal behaviour online, cybercrime, which is well reported by other agencies.
Burgess also criticised tech companies for resisting requests by security agencies to access information in cyberspace. Analysts say his comments are a strong hint that Australia's intelligence community wants new powers to access end-to-end encrypted content. The technology is used for various legitimate reasons, including commerce and banking. The ASIO boss said there was a need for the balance between privacy and security to be reappraised in favour of law enforcement and national security. It's a move described by civil liberties campaigners as a power grab. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
The tragic death of George Floyd has inspired more than just massive demonstrations. It has also inspired material for dozens of musicians wanting to have a voice. Grammy-nominated R&B singer Trey Songz said the pain in his gut was so heavy he couldn't even get it out until going into the streets of Los Angeles with thousands of others who gave him the strength to come back and finish his song, 2020 Riots, How Many Times? The song released last Friday is one of many from other artists in the wake of Floyd's and other African-American killings. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Bungangi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you so much for listening.